There's no better time than summer to visit the Finger Lakes wine region in upstate New York. And if you are a sommelier, wine retail professional, or beverage writer working anywhere in the world, I've got an invitation for you. From July 21st through July 23rd, experience majestic Finger Lakes vineyards, wines, regional cuisine, and the people behind it all with the New York Wine and Grape Foundation. There'll be hands-on experiences, lots of time in the vine rows and wineries, and the vignerons will be right there to learn from. This is a chance to go beyond book knowledge and to see the region for yourself. You'll be in a particularly beautiful part of the world and among other super motivated wine folks just like yourself. Also, there is no cost to you. Transportation and lodging will be provided. In-depth experiential learning will be organized for your benefit, and you'll have plenty of time to take in the breathtaking views of some of the world's deepest lakes. Fill out the form you can find at nydrinksny.com/LEVI with your job title and contact information, and you'll receive more information about this distinctively New York opportunity for beverage professionals. That's nydrinksny.com/LEVI if you are interested in traveling to the Finger Lakes region in New York State. Here's what buyer Tim Farrell of Brooklyn Wine Exchange had to say about his visit. I feel like we covered more on the history and terroir of the region in 2.5 days than we do on trips to other regions that last 3 times as long. As attendees, we really got to see a serious lineup of producers, and it was a supremely enjoyable and educational trip. Apply for your spot today. VKNOW, VKNOW, is an interactive course designed to teach you about wine using an adaptive learning method that customizes itself to your level of knowledge. It's pretty cool technology, so you really get out of it exactly what you want to know. Videos, pop quizzes, it's fun. Curated and led by Caleb Ganser, sommelier and managing partner at Les Compagnies des Vins Surnaturels, Caleb is passionate about wine, and he's passionate about sharing it with you. Download in the App Store or Google Play for $8.99, which is like less than a glass of wine at most places. And you can use it whenever, wherever. Basically, it's a wine boot camp packaged into a teeny tiny app. Rajat Parr is one advocate.
Hi, it's Rajat Parr from Santa Barbara, partner winemaker at Sandy, Dumaine de la Cote, and Eveningland. In this vast world of wine, it's very hard to learn all the different things about grapes, winemaking, and all the characteristics. And Vino, I think, is an amazing way to learn that. Caleb Ganser, who's a great guy, a great sommelier, and a brilliant wine mind, is a great educator, and he has put together an amazing program where you guys can learn about wine. And it's also interactive, so it depends on how much you know. If you know a lot about wine, you only learn about the things you don't know about, so you'll learn from the basics. Or if you start as a basic, you learn how to understand wine from a beginner's perspective. I think it's an amazing, amazing, amazing way of learning. I wish I had this 20 years ago, and I hope you guys learn a lot.
Available via the App Store, Google Play, or visit vknowwine.com. You can find VKNOW on Instagram at vknowwine. Get VKNOW. Now you know. I'll Drink to That, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today. Joe Rocchioli Jr. of the J. Rocchioli Winery in the Russian River Valley of California. Hello, sir. How are you?
Good.
So your family moved to California in the early 1900s.
Yes, my dad moved in with his family in 1902.
You were born in 1934.
Born in 34.
What was California like when you were a kid?
When we were young, we didn't get around very much, but we lived pretty much on the ranch. And it was totally different than what it is today. You know, there was old farmers, they were all hop growers, and some had some vineyards, but the hop fields were a big thing then, and they had kids, but the kids moved on because there wasn't very much money to be made in hops.
Your dad had worked as a hops farmer.
Yeah, my dad was a hop farmer, and he was a good one. We leased the property in those days from a lady called Adelma Walters Fenton, but her maiden name was Walters. And then she married a Fenton, who was the Fenton family is known for their attorneys in Portland, Oregon. They built the library at the University of Oregon called Fenton Hall, and she married one of the boys when she was younger, and he was an All-American football player and baseball player in Stanford University, and I have his yearbook and his footballs and his baseballs from the years that he played at Stanford. Then they got married and went to Portland, Oregon, and he went in the business and the firm that his family owned. And they lived there for, I think, 3 or 4 years, and then she came home back to the ranch. And come to find out, he was suicidal and committed suicide. And anyway, she had a brother. Her brother and her split the property. And we raised hops till 1953. And then about that time, my dad was able to buy the property from Mrs. Fenton, we called her.
And she gave you 5 acres of land for your birthday.
Yeah, and then she gave me 5 acres and my brother 5 acres. When I came home from the Army, I didn't have any money. I mean, I was flat broke, you know. Army pay was, I got $137.50 a month. And Tom was born while I was in the Army, my son Tom. But my dad knew some people, and he told Mr. Proctor, he says, you know, my son would like to build a home, but he has no money. And Mr. Proctor owned half of Santa Rosa, and he was in the hop business. He told my dad how much he want. My dad said, I don't know, how much do you want? And I said, I don't know, probably $15,000. He just wrote me out a check. He said, you pay me back whenever you can, no interest. So built my own house. Took me 3 years to do it, but I got it done. And it was up on a hill where I used to chase my cow around. I used to milk 2 cows, and I used to have to go up in those hills and run them down to the barn. You know, I started doing that when I was 10 years old, and I used to sit up there once in a while and look out and see, just, you could see clear to Hillsburg. It was a nice view. And thinking that maybe someday I'd like to build a house up there. And so then I got this property, and I built the house.
Used to work with your dad with the bags of hops.
When I was 10 years old, I picked hops. And I was the world's worst hop picker. I hated it. You know, you sit there and pick berry after berry. And if you can make 100 pounds in one day, then you're really doing something at 2 cents a pound. Anyway, that was when I was 10. So then I kept telling my dad that, you know, I'd like to get a man's job. Get on the payroll, it's 50 cents an hour. So finally, when I was 12, I grew up fast. I was 6 foot tall, and I wore 12 shoes when I was 12 years old. And my dad gave me a job, what they call high pole, and I had a long pole. And when they pull the hops down, some of the limbs would stay there. Then you'd have to go along with this pole, take them down and give them to the pickers so they could pick them out. So I did that for 2 years. And then when I got into high school, I got a job in the hop kilns.
You were a good athlete, right?
Yeah, I was kind of shy and kind of timid. But when I was playing in grammar schools, hitting the softball a mile, and I used to practice in the apple orchard hitting the apples that were falling on the ground with a stick. And I used to throw, hit a tree and stuff, developing my arm. The grammar school I went to, I couldn't speak any English. It was difficult, but I made it. But they never had any football, and I never saw football. So when I went into high school, my freshman year, I had a class from the football coach. And it was raining, so I took a shortcut and went through the gym, and they had just finished the gym. So I didn't realize he was behind me, and I slid on the gym floor with my shoes. And I used to put horseshoes on my heels those days. And boy, he was mad. He yelled at me, and I thought he was going to hit me. He was really mad. Art McCaffrey, he was a good man. Anyway, he told me that I was going to get so many demerits and get kicked out of school for 3 days or do 100 push-ups. Well, I was already working tough, and I did 100 push-ups, bang, 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 bang. And he says, "You ever think about playing football?" I says, "No, I don't even know what a football is." He says, "What if I went out and talked to your dad and got to talk him into letting you play?" So he did. So I started playing football. I mean, they gave me a uniform. I didn't know how to put it on, but the kids, they helped me put the uniform on, and they were already playing. So I went out, and at calisthenics, I did pretty good, but then it made me take a lap, and I couldn't quite make it, so it was difficult. Then I started running through plays, but there was contact, and I never had contact before. So my coach says, "Rocchioli, stand right over here." I'm standing there, you know, wondering what in the hell is going on. You know, they were going 1st and 10. I didn't understand any of that stuff. So I'm standing there looking around. Pretty soon, some guy by the name of Alvy Rochester, he weighed about 150 pounds. He was a guard, and he pulled and hit me. Oh, I thought I was dead. I says, "Wow, the hell." And then the coach took me out. Then they were still going on, and I'm trying to figure this game out. Then finally, he says, "Rocchioli, stand over here." So I'm standing on the opposite side. And this guy, Alvy Rochester, hit me again. And he had a grin on his face, you know. I was mad. Anyway, I ended up playing first string. And then my junior year and senior year, I was first string, all league, both ways, unanimous choice. Means that all the coaches voted for me. I was going to go to school, and I was going to go to Davis because it's close by. And some doctor, Dr. Cruikshank, came in to our class, FFA class, and gave us a spiel on Cal Poly, why we should go to Cal Poly. And he impressed me so much that I told my dad, "I'm going to Cal Poly," because the motto was learn by doing. And I liked that. You know, you take a class, and then you go out in the field and do it. So I went to Cal Poly. My dad gave me $350, and I took off, went down there, and I got 2 jobs. There's no tuition in those days, and all you had to do was buy a meal ticket.
Your dad used to have some French Calabar planted, right?
Yeah, we had French Calabar. You know, when the hops went, we tried beans, and there was no money in the beans. We had very little income. After the hops, we planted 10 acres of beans, and then we had old vineyards. You know, we had vineyards that were planted in 1895 from Solomon Walters. And those vineyards were producing very little. And we were making just barely enough to plant some vineyards. So we planted two rows of beans and then put two rows of vineyard vines in between the beans. And the beans were getting to where we couldn't get any help, no labor. So 1964 was the end of it. But in the meantime, I had an idea that I wanted to get into the grape business. I loved grapes, you know, and I used to prune when I was 10 years old. I helped my dad. I still have the pruning shears, German-made razors. So I tried to talk my dad into planting some varietals. Oh, no, no. He says, what do you do with varietals? He said, they don't bear. That's a waste of money. So finally, I convinced him to plant some French Colombard. So we got the budwood from the neighbor, Vince Colombano, up the road. And he had some vines there, so we got enough budwood. And the Ottoboni brothers in Cloverdale did some budding, so they budded them. And they took off like crazy. They were huge. I mean, they were spread out all over the rows. You know, there was no more beans. Couldn't plant anything in there because it was so brushy. So we pulled the beans out. Then I wanted to plant another block. My dad had it all disked up and everything. And I wanted to plant Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, but my uncles and my dad says, oh, no, 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 no. And they were right, really, because there was no wineries. You know, the bulk wineries only. They just buy in bulk. When you brought something in, it was mixed red or mixed white, and it all went to Gallo. So when we got paid, we got it from Gallo, whenever he wanted to pay us. I said this on this other thing, and you know, everybody says, oh, don't mention names. Well, I said it, Vince Colombano said it, and everybody, that we used to get paid just before our taxes, before December the 10th, for grapes we picked in September and October. They were delivered, crushed, probably made into wines, I don't know. And we never got paid until December the 10th, and then he paid whatever he wanted. And I didn't like that. So we started a little organization called North Coast Grape Growers Association, and we fought open price contracts. We thought that was illegal, should be.
What you guys fought for was that there should be a written contract with a price before the grapes were delivered.
Exactly, which is the law now. So we argued and argued. We started again, and I sold a little bit of grapes to Corbell. I sold some to Wente, and they paid me a little more than Gallo. So we wanted that printed in Market News Service. They wouldn't print it. They said it's insignificant, but it meant something. So we fought and fought, and we got a congressman to sponsor a bill to ban open price contracts. And we went over there to Sacramento, and they thought, my God, you mean you're selling grapes without a price? I said, yeah. It was a committee. I says, okay, well, so we can change that. And there was two people that were Gallo and CPC, California Packing Corporation. They lobbied against it. And so when we went, we thought we had it made. You know, we're going to get this law passed. So we went in to the room to vote. Only two guys showed up, died from a lack of a quorum. This went right back to where we were. Anyway, we fought it, but eventually the state did pass a law saying that when you deliver grapes, you got to have a contract or an agreement.
So what did you find with the early experiments working with French Colombard?
You know, we were getting good production, and it was making us a little money. And my dad liked it because it was producing. So then I said, what about planting some, the next block? And when it was time to get budwood, University of California, I did a lot of work with Casmatis and Leiter. They were big names in the university at that time. So I went over and they showed me that I could take budwood from their Sauvignon Blanc experimental rows. So I took my dad over there, and he saw it had a huge crop. He said, well, maybe we could plant some of that. The whole block was really loaded. Sauvignon Blanc had a big crop that year. Thank God for that. Otherwise, I don't know if it had any. So he said, okay, but they weren't ready to bud yet. So when it's time to bud, I had an old 47 Chevy pickup, and I put sideboards on it, and my dad couldn't go, so I went by myself. I went over to Davis, and there was about 12 rows with numbers on the end. They were ripe then. So I started tasting those, each one of those rows, tasting them. And I found one row that I really liked. It had a dried fig flavor. It was really something. And I didn't know if it was good or bad, but I took all my budwood off of that row. And we still have that vineyard still producing. I budded them myself. You know, it took me about 5 days to do it, but I could bud. I was a budder.
You were famous for it, right?
Yeah, I was famous for it because I was budding 500 a day, 6 days a week. I was budding with two famous butters, Enrico Tolini and Mr. Qualia. Qualia was from Napa, Tolini from Cloverdale. And they taught me how to bud, those guys. But they'd only bud about 350 a day, and I was budding 500 a day. I was doing their rows and my rows, you know. So finally, I went on my own and said, I'm going to charge by the bud. So I was doing $50 a day instead of $37.50.
And you used to go out to other vineyards that your dad didn't own.
I budded just about all the vineyards around. You can't believe how many vineyards I budded in Sonoma County. I did a lot of budding. Now I go by and I said, told my wife, see those vines? At one time I budded there. Most of them have been pulled out now. See. So then I'm still set on getting some varietals in, some Sauvignon. So in 1952, we planted early Burgundies, an 8-acre block of early Burgundies. And that's what I wanted to put the Pinot Noir. And my dad said, no. I wanted a French clone, not Gamay Beaujolais, you know, that was supposed to be a Pinot Noir that produced 10 tons to the acre. You know, it was rosé. When you produce 10 tons to the acre, you don't get any color, no quality. So I made up my mind I wanted to get a French clone because I read a little bit when I was in college about the Burgundy area was planting these grapes, and they were selling for big money. So I thought, maybe that's the thing to do. So I wanted to put them in, but my dad said no. So we put in early Burgundy's, the worst grape that I think we ever planted. And in 1966, my dad passed away. So first thing I did is I had an old tractor. I made a shoe that would dig underneath the roots and pull the vines out. And it was raining. It was wet. It had to be because, the ground gets hard. So I went in there, and I worked and worked, and I got all the vines out, 8 acres of vines, piled them up and burned them, and then disced it, got it ready, and planted AXR1 rootstock. I looked for a clone of Pinot Noir, a French clone, and when I was on the board of directors of the North Coast Grape Growers, one of the directors in Napa knew of somebody that had planted some Pommard clone just below St. Helena. So I went over there. He took me down there, and there was an old man that came out. And he says, no, I'm not going to let anybody cut on my vines. And we explained to him that I was an old butter, and I knew how to take the wood off the vines without hurting them. And his daughter comes out, and she was starting to take over the ranch, so she gave me an okay. So I got my budwood. I think it was Mr. Mihaly was his name. So anyway, I planted those, and for the first few years, I had some beautiful grapes there, but they went into mixed reds, less than 100 a ton. Anyway, that's where Pinot Noir started. Then I put in another clone from Wendy. And Wendy was giving budwood away to other growers, but he had a special clone he told me about. I know Carl Wendy well. He's dead. He died young. But he told me that I couldn't have his special one. I said, come on, Carl. I'm just going to put in a little 4 acres. Finally, he gave me some of that budwood. We planted it. Every time we replant it someplace, I'd mark the stakes with the staples. And if it's a good one, I put one staple on it. If it's a very good one, I put two staples on it. They were permanent. That's where we got our budwood. Then we went to the next field, and then we did it again, you know. So now there's people out there call it the Rocchioli clone. It's a little different than some of the others.
So the thing about that is, historically,
that was some of the first Pinot Noir planted in Sonoma County. Well, there's some claims that Joe Swan, he was the one that was experimenting with varietal Pinot Noirs. He was one of the first. And Botch Kloppe claims they put it in before me, and he said I butted it. I'm not sure about that. It could be true.
Working with Sauvignon Blanc and then now working with Pinot Noir, what did you learn working with those grape varieties?
Well, what happened is these little wineries started building up. Dry Creek Vineyards, one of the first ones. Davis Bynum was one of the first ones. Davis Bynum is the first one to put my name on the bottle and Russian River Valley. Popiano says he was the first one, so you don't know, you know, but it was on a jug wine. So anyway, I had beautiful fruit. The budwood that I got was really excellent, and I kept it, you know. I used to thin it, take the green bunches off or rotten bunches or second crop bunches, you know. It wasn't the money, it was pride. My dad was the same way. He didn't care about the money, but he wanted to be the best. And I wanted to be the best. So I have a lot of money, but you know what? It doesn't mean anything to me. I live in an old house. But anyway, this went on for several years. And then I started getting premium prices for my grapes. I sold Dry Creek the very first Sauvignon Blanc. They didn't even have the winery built yet. I had to haul it to Couvesson. And Dave Stair and I unloaded it off a gondola into the crusher. It's hard to believe Dave Stair would do any work, but he did. Dave Stair going to hear this?
I don't know.
I saw him the other day. Talked to me. But he started buying from me steady for about 6 years.
Because he became famous for Sauvignon Blanc.
He was planting some out there by his winery. And until that came in, he was buying them from me. So then I sold that Sauvignon Blanc to Corbel. I sold to Corbel French Colombards about 30 years. When I first started hauling to Corbel, they didn't even have a crusher. Or just a little. You had to do one box at a time. And it was amazing how it grew up. and huge buildings gone in, and crushers and big tanks. It got big, real big. But anyway, the Pinot Noir is still my pride and joy.
The property's gotten bigger over time, but the original set was the West Block, the East Block, and then you were farming Allen as well, right?
Right. Yeah, I've leased Allen's a 72. Howard Allen was a very nice person. He always let me do what I want. He told me that you do what you want, plant what you want, and sell to whoever you want. So I had that relationship, and finally I got it in writing. So I could take Allen's grapes and put it in our wine, and it'd be estate wines. So anyway, he was a super nice guy, Howard Allen, but he passed away. And I also made him famous because, you know, the wineries were putting Rocchioli on the label. But I told him, why don't you put Howard Allen on the Chardonnay that, you know, Gary Farrell Wines and William and Sellum Wines buying Chardonnay from Howard Allen and Pinot Noir.
Allen is across the creek and across the road from your property. And how do you see the differences between Allen, West Block, East Block, now River Block, Three Corners?
The only difference would be that Allen's Pinot Noirs are all on the benchlands. His Chardonnay is next to the river down low. There's 16 acres there. And I started planting that in 1972. I planted Allen's Chardonnay, and it's still there. You know, we had the old place leased at Prune Orchard on it. Then he wanted to jerk it all out, and we did. And then the Three Corner was Allen's at one time. And I did so much for him. His wife says, you know, we owe you something. And so they were going to give me the Three Corner. There's 3 acres of vineyard there. So he come up and told me, he says, we're going to give you that for everything you've done for us. Without you, we wouldn't have made it here. And, you know, they were making money too. So they gave it to me. But he's got a son that's an attorney who's running the place now. Him and I don't see eye to eye a lot of things. So he came back a week later and told me, he says, you know, I was thinking about it. Rather than give it to you, I'll give you a 30-year lease. I said, Howie, you gave it to me. I have told all my friends and everything that how nice you were to, you know. Yeah, but we were thinking that it'd be better if we gave you a 30-year lease. And I said, well, then you'd take it away from me. He says, no. He says, you still have it for 30 years. And I says, no, that's not the same. So they went back and thought about it. I told them, you know what? You know, I just didn't like what you just did. I think that's going to ruin our relationship here. And he came back the following week and says, no, we're going to give it to you. They made out of all the paperwork. Give me Three Corner now. But we planted Chardonnay on our property. I cleared some land down by the river, and we put in a block of Chardonnay. It's called the River Block. And then up on the hill, I planted some way back in 70, same time I planted Howard Allen. There's still one block left of that old vineyard. And then we put in a little block on the Sweetwater property, just over the hill from where Tom's house is, where I used to live. And it's called Rachel's Vineyard. That's his daughter's name. And it's a Mount Eden clone, and it's very, very good. That's the best Chardonnay that my wife says is the best in the world, but he's a little prejudiced, maybe.
I feel like you've had success with all three of those grape varieties, Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Noir, and Chardonnay. Other people have also shared in that success in terms of wineries who have come to you and sourced fruit, right?
Yeah, well, like William and Sayam, they were getting some of the old West Block and making some of the best Pinot Noir in the world. Bert Williams was a good winemaker. Then, after, I think, 9 years, partners were feuding a little bit, so they sold it to John Dyson. But they came to me and said that, you know, we want to buy it, but are you going to sell us the grapes? And I says, well, I don't know. I says, you know, it all depends on a lot of things. You know, I had a good relationship with Bert and Ed. You know, they really treated me good. And so they said, well, we'll treat you good too. We'll give you top dollar. And if you don't give us an okay to buy your grapes, then we're not going to have a deal. The banks won't let us go through the deal. So I gave them an okay.
How did you first meet Bert Williams?
Well, we heard about in Fulton, they had just a regular two-car garage. And they had barrels in there, and there was a loading chute there for loading discs and tractors and stuff. And we went over there, and they were working away. Never had a lift or nothing. They were rolling the barrels. They'd roll them up on the loading chute, and then drain them, take them down, and wash them. I mean, I sold them the very first grapes. They made it, and it was excellent Pinot Noir. And it was crude, the way they were making it. But they knew what they were doing.
You sold to Davis Bynum, and then when Farrell started his own wine, you sold to Gary Farrell.
Yeah, I started selling to Davis Bynum in 73. He was one of the first wineries around. So Davis Bynum, you know, he used to live at Berkeley, and he'd come up 2 to 3 days a week, and he had his son running it for a while, and wasn't getting the best of care. So he hired Gary Farrell. Gary Farrell's a good winemaker. I'd bring grapes down there. He'd take care of them and everything. Before, I would bring some of the most prettiest grapes you ever saw down there, putting them down in bins, and they'd been to stay overnight. Guys are in the tasting room drinking and getting knockered up. And I was mad, and I didn't have bins to pick the next day. And finally, Davis Bynum came up, boy, and he was mad. He shook everybody up and fired a bunch of people. And then he got Gary Farrell in. And after Gary Farrell come in, everything went smooth. He was one of the top winemakers in the area. I just saw him Saturday night. Now he's working on old cars.
When you decided to start your own winery, you started making some wine under the Fenton Acres label at Davis Bynum, right?
Yes. I had two partners, and the three of us started this Fenton Acres label. That was the name of the ranch since 1926, when Mrs. Fenton came back from Oregon. And that went on for a while, and we were making 1,000 cases of each, Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. And then all of a sudden, these guys, they had other interests. You know, one guy was working on a sailboat in Marin County, and the other one had property over in Ketchum, Idaho. He was building apartments. And, you know, here I was stranded with all this wine. It was hard to sell in those days. You know, we didn't have a name, or the wines were pretty good. You know, down at Davis Bynum, they got neglected. Davis Bynum's was supposed to make the wine. We bought new barrels. We bought a couple of tanks and everything. And God, I went down there one day and I saw film on, wine was down about this much in the barrels, and it was awful. But we got a bronze medal at the Harvest Fair, so it's better than nothing, I guess. Then all of a sudden they had these other interests, these guys, and Tom comes along, my son Tom. He was working in corporate banking, Bank of America. And he hated his job. He came to me and said, Dad, is there anything that I can do on a ranch? Well, on a ranch, no. You know, I could handle that easily. But that winemaking thing was something I needed help with. So I said, once you put together a 10,000 case winery and do all the numbers, he had a degree in business and accounting. So he comes back and looked too good for me. Says, something wrong here. Nothing but money. So I chopped it up a little bit, and it still looked good. So I said, okay, I want to take you in as a partner, and I'm going to get rid of the other partners. Oh, they were mad. They were really upset. I told them, I said, you know, you guys are not doing nothing. What do you want to be a partner for? We'll divide the wines up. You take your share, and we'll go from there. Took Tom in. Never had one class in viticulture. And we hired Gary Farrell for 1 year to help set up the tanks and stuff. Then Tom just kind of walked around with Gary Farrell and listened, and I could not believe how much he learned. You know, he's using terminology that I was making wines when I was a young man for my family in the back of the barn. I was making 300 gallons a year from the family. So he really learned fast. So after 1 year, we said, well, I don't think we need Gary Farrell anymore. And then Tom's been the winemakers now, since 1985. I give Tom a lot of credit. You know, if it wasn't for Tom, I wouldn't be here today. Not in the wine business, anyway.
In terms of farming Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Noir, and Chardonnay, what were some of the things that you learned in the early years that kind of stuck with you?
Well, particularly the Sauvignon Blanc, we didn't realize that it was very vigorous. And when it grew, I mean, it looked like a jungle. We call it the jungle today. The Mexicans all call it the jungle. You know, the rows were 14 foot apart, and the brush was all tangled up. You couldn't even drive down the row. So what happened was that when it had grapes on it, the sunshine never got in there. And so it was cane pruned. And then we put two canes on each side, and the canes, you couldn't even get in there to cut the bunches off. They were tangled up in there, so it was awful. And the brush was awful. And then it was shaded out, the wood, so it didn't store up any carbohydrate in the wood. And it got punky for the following year when you put canes out. There were spots on the canes that didn't produce anything. So the university says you put one cane and all your canes on the bottom wire. This is a two-wire system. Then you leave the top wire as the catch wire. Just shade the grapes. Well, the Sauvignon Blanc, I didn't need to shade the grapes. I needed the wire to put the canes on. So I started putting the canes on the top wire and the bottom wire, four canes.
So that would be like vertical shoot positioning, right?
Yeah.
That would be similar to that, right? That
similar.
Idea?
Yes. So then they had a meeting, and they told me that what you're doing is wrong. The university doesn't recommend it. But he said, if you go to the meeting, I want you to tell them how you do it. And Dale Good was a friend of mine. He did it the right way.
Of Murphy Good.
Yeah, Murphy Good. He was partner in there, yeah. Super nice guy. He's dead now. So I got up there and I showed him how I was doing it, you know. And next thing I know, you drive down the road and look at this pruning. They're all using that top wire. And about 10 years later, university come out and recommended to use the top wire because there was a lot of vigor, and you didn't need to worry about sunburn. So then, you know, we started pulling leaves through the middle of on the shady side, not where the afternoon sun hits them.
So you were pulling in the fruit zone on one side.
Yeah, fruit zone on one side, on the east side. You get in the morning sun, but not the late afternoon hot sun. So then next thing I know, more people were doing it. And it made sense. If you do it early, the vines get adjusted to the heat, and they won't sunburn. But if you wait too late and pull it, then you get burnt maybe in the grapes or something like that. So you got to do it at the right time.
So the skins themselves kind of develop a sensitivity if you do it early.
Yeah.
And what did you learn about dropping fruit?
Yeah, that's the other thing. You know, we learned like some years, Pinot Noir, you don't have to worry too much about them. But some years they put on a pretty good crop, you know, and... Well, sometimes I go through there four or five times. Go through first, get the site crop off, then go through again and get bunches that are thick, you know, thin them out a little bit. We go through again sometimes and get the greener bunches that are starting to get verasion. We go and get the ones that are still way behind, cut them out. Then we go through again if they start to show a little rot or something. Take it off, especially the whites. So, you know, it's a never-ending job. I've got, right now, I think I got 12 or 14 guys working, a couple ladies, and I got a huge labor bill. It's more than half my income. But I get the highest price probably of anybody. So I can afford to keep my crop down to 2 tons to the acre. Sometimes we make 2 3/4, but very seldom over 3.
You must have seen a lot of changes in the Russian River in terms of people planting more and more grapes, right?
Well, yeah. We're still seeing it. Next to us, there's 6 wineries within a mile of where I live. The land prices went up out of sight, and now these rich people coming in, billionaires, buying. No matter what, they just buy it. It's in the Russian River Valley, particularly in what we call the Middle Reach. When we first started, we thought the Russian River Valley was from Dry Creek to the Waller Bridge. Davis Bynum and I, and even Fulpiano, thought that was the Russian River Valley.
Which is like a 10-mile stretch, right?
Yeah. But now, Russian River Valley Appalachian, as big as there is, is clear to Petaluma. We talked about it, to maybe get another Appalachian for the Middle Reach. But nobody wants to instigate it, and I don't think the government would allow it.
What do you see as the characteristics of that kind of 8 to 11-mile area that you're in?
Well, you could tell, I mean, you know, I know that on our wines, there's a particular nose that comes off of that wine that you don't get in other areas.
There's kind of a red fruit signature often for me for Russian River Valley Pinot. There's a pungency of red fruit to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do too.
You get some fog in your area, right?
Yeah, we have fog. That's one of the, you know, keeps the grapes cool at night. And it comes up the river as far as the Dry Creek, probably, where Dry Creek dumps into the Russian River. And that's a good thing, those foggy nights. Then the days get up in the 80s and, you know, that's good for the grapes.
So that actually provides for diurnal temperature variation, the fog. It keeps the acidity because... It actually lowers the temperature at night.
That's right.
But that must be tough for moisture on the grapes sometimes, right? Does the
fog? Oh yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's when the ripe grapes will mildew if you're not careful. So that's why we got a real strict spray program, so that fog will make mildew. The spores really multiply. So we don't go past 2 weeks without spraying. Sometimes 10 days. They have what they call mildew pressures. We have instruments that measure the mildew pressure. If you get mildew pressures up around 100 and it stays for a while, you better get back in there within 10 days or else you're going to get some mildew. So, we're on top of that. So we have instruments in the field that tells you everything. We have one up in the hill, one down in the flat that measures the temperatures, the rainfalls, the mildew pressures, mildew spores, stuff like that.
What are issues that you used to have to deal with in the 70s that are less relevant now?
When I was a kid, we had about 30 acres of old vines, Alicante, Grand Or, Petite Syrah, Malvasia, some of these varieties. And when I was a young kid, I used to help sulfur. We put sulfur in a barley sack and just puff it over the top of a vine. We do that twice a year and never did anything else. Now, those sprayers are running every 2 weeks. It's unbelievable. And the insects, we never had insects in those days. I don't know what the heck, and viruses. We had a little bit of virus in those days, a leaf roll virus. Now we got red blotch. They said that leaf roll virus cannot be spread except by propagation. You take it off of one vine, you can put it on another. But if you don't have it, you got a clean vine, you can put it on a clean rootstock and you won't get it. Well, now I got red blotch and all the vines are getting it, it's spreading by, they don't even know. So a three-nose alfalfa something, they don't know what's causing the red blotch. And we had our vines tested. We found 4 or 5 vines that never had red blotch. So we propagated those, and we have 75 vines now that are clean from red blotch, and we're taking all our budwood off of that for our new plantings.
Have there been other challenges that have developed through the decades, so in California grape growing?
There's not too many challenges because it's pretty lucrative right now. Everybody's trying to get into it. And everybody is. Let me tell you, the rich people have taken it over. We have a road going back the hills behind us, Sweetwater Springs Road. When I was a kid, I used to ride a lot of horses. We'd run up and down that road. It was all dirt. Now, there's homes going in everywhere. The one ranch was 2,000 acres. It was a sheep ranch. It's been split up, I don't know how many ways now. And they're building multi-million-dollar homes. And the traffic is something else. Now they paved some of it. Just big build. One guy built a house next to us down there. It's 9 rooms, 9 bedrooms. The monstrosity looks like a hotel. They took the old farmhouse that friends of mine grew up in and made it 2 stories and expanded it. They're just going like crazy. They're building, building, building. There's new wineries going in everywhere.
Do you have blocks in your vineyard that you particularly like to work? Are there blocks that are sort of your favorite blocks?
Oh, the old West block is still one of my favorites. There's only 4 acres left. Their vines were planted in 1970. They're old vines and don't produce much, but they still make a damn good wine. And then the old River block, it's a nice block. William and Celia make a nice wine out of it.
I imagine there's a lot of people asking you for fruit, right? Like a lot of people you haven't worked with before.
Well, I have a list of 35 wineries that want my fruit. And I told them they'll never get it. You know, there's no way.
How did you originally pick the people that you wanted to work with for buying your fruit?
They picked me.
Yeah.
I just got a reputation early, and everybody wanted my fruit. So I sell to Ramey, White Grapes, Gary Farrell, both, and William Sellium, both.
What are vintages that have really stood out for you?
Well, those vintages stood out because of bad things. Like 81, we got rains, ruined most of the Chardonnay. Had very little Chardonnay that was good. Most years, though, our fruit, we don't have too many bad years. You know, it's getting earlier and earlier. We used to pick in September, now we're picking in August.
Red in August.
Yeah, Pinot Noir. Still wine, fruit, is coming in earlier and earlier, seems like.
Today, when you look back, what do you see as kind of your legacy for farming grape varieties in the Russian River in California?
I had the idea of putting in varietals, and I don't know if anybody else did, but I was determined. You know, it was tough for me to get past my dad and in my uncles, Sodini and Spraja and all the old-timers. You know, they had the old varieties. So I was determined to do varietals and make, you know, wines like the best in the world. That was my goal. And I sacrificed a lot to do that. You know, those guys, like I was hauling Pinot Noir in and dumping it, getting 3 tons to the acre. And the guy next to me said, "What the hell are you bringing that stuff in for that?" He said, "I'm getting 10 tons to the acre with this Gamay's here." And he used to call Gamay Pinot Noir.
Has it surprised you how much Pinot Noir and Chardonnay have caught on in the Russian River Valley over the years?
It's almost shocking. It's not stopping. I see vineyards going in. You know, Sebastopol used to be all apples. Now it's all grapes. That's an area that's shocking. You hardly see an apple. Used to be all apples.
What are you most proud of in your career?
Well, the grape growing and my athletic stuff, you know. Hit a lot of home runs. And also, I learned by doing. I built my own house. I did all my equipment. I rebuilt the engines. I welded everything and put everything together. In those days, it wasn't a lot of money. So you had to do, I built all my own bins. I built my hydraulic dumper. I built the first cane cutter in the county. I made a cane cutter. I told you the big brushy vines that we had down there. First year, I used a machete with four Mexicans and took them about 4 days to do it. Then I found a sickle bar and I put it on motor on it and a clutch, put it on the front end of my old 9N loader. And I went through and did it all one day the following year. With a cane cutter. I still have it. It's still in the yard over there. And I restored all my horse-drawn cultivators and plows. I restored them. They're in the barn upstairs. I got a buggy. My dad bought that buggy, and it's old. And I clean it up, and it's still got the original paint on it and everything. But we got robbed here about 2 years ago, and they stole the harness. But I was able to buy a harness for it, but it's not the same as the old one. It has stainless steel on the, some parts of it. So kind of upset me. But anyway, my barn is a big barn, 2 stories, 60 by 60, and it's full. I just saved everything. And I still have all my saddles. I have 5 saddles hanging in there. When I used to ride a lot, my dad rode, and my uncle, you know, we were, you know, rode a lot in horses in those days. When those first started back in 37, we used to work the land with mules. My dad had 2 beautiful mules, and my sister and I were only 3 or 4 years old. We used to run down the field at 5 o'clock, and then we'd get a ride back on the mules. So those are good old days.
Joe Rocchioli Jr. built a house with his own hands that overlooked the vines that he planted. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
Joe Rocchioli Jr. of J. Rocchioli Winery in the Russian River of California. There's a great opportunity for you to check out Oregon Wines coming up on May 6th at the Altman Building in Manhattan. 60 different wineries will be pouring several of their wines in a walk-around tasting, and snacks will be provided by Oregon culinary partners such as the Oregon Cheese Guild, Olympia Provisions, and Stumptown Coffee Roasters. The trade tasting will be from 1 to 4:30 p.m. on May 6th, and will also feature trade educational pop-up seminars at 2:30 p.m. and 4, led by Master of Wine Bree Stock and Master Sommelier Chris Tanguy. There will also be a public consumer tasting on that same day, May 6th, from 6:30 to 9 p.m. for those of you in the public that would like to join. Go to oregonwine.org/trail to purchase consumer tickets or to register as trade. That's oregonwine.org/trail for more information and for tickets. Taste for yourself the diverse heights that Oregon wines are reaching right now on May 6th at the Altman Building in Manhattan. This episode was made possible by the Sonoma County Vintners, the leading voice of Sonoma County wine, dedicated to raising awareness of Sonoma County as one of the world's premier wine regions. Visit SonomaWine.com for more information. That's SonomaWine.com for more information.
I just like to fix up old things. You know, there was a house there when my folks moved. It was burned down before they moved there, but they remembered it. It was built in 1880. Solomon Walters built it. 2-story Victorian, beautiful home, right where our tasting room entry is. And it burned down November 7th, 1930. But my folks remembered it. But what didn't burn down was the outhouse in the back of the house. So we moved it around for years and years and years and years. And finally, I says, you know what? I'm going to restore that thing. And I did. The beautiful outhouse. The 3-holder, mama, papa, baby hole. And I put all the same wood back. I pulled the square nails out, straightened them, took the boards, marked them all, put them back. The only thing I had to change was the bottom was rotting out. And I could buy the same lumber that they put in there. And then the roof was rotting out, so I put, instead of redwood, I used cedar, which just looks just like it, shakes, just like it was, has beautiful hinges on it, and it has a window. And I got it out there on cement next to the tasting room parking lot.